Hello and welcome to Brain Trust Live number 320.
This week on the podcast, as the Earth literally shook all around us this week, at least we could take comfort in the fact that the USGS was having the best week ever.
And Donald Trump regaled us with tales of 4th of July glory, commemorating the forgotten battle of LaGuardia, Terminal C.
Plus, somehow Pete Buttigieg is now the fundraiser to beat in the Democratic primary.
The census citizenship question just won't die, possibly because neither will Donald Trump.
And Justin Amash, founding member of the Freedom Caucus, is leaving the GOP because it's too radical for him.
Plus, Marianne Williamson has more in common with Mormonism's Joseph Smith than you'd want or need.
We'll have all this and more.
This is Brain Trust Live. Hey guys, I'm Brent.
I'm Lila, and you can find us on the web at www.braintrustlive.com.
2 weeks in a row.
Coming at you.
Yeah.
Every single week for 2 weeks.
That's right.
We've I know. Finally got it back.
Right. It's amazing that we did like almost 300 of them without missing a week. Like
did
to the point
5 years
of, like,
of this without
insane
missing a week.
Obsession. And then like just like went off the rails.
In the last year we've been a mess. But we're coming back because also the last year wasn't the most important year. I know it seemed like it was because Donald Trump was the president last year, too. But
right.
This
it
year
probably
is...
felt that way because every day was like some insane news story. But
and this year is election season, which is what we actually are here for. You might recall we started in the 2012 primaries. We are nerds for primary season.
Right.
We're not afraid to love a primary season. So we're about to be super invested again.
Right.
You'll be hearing from us week after week.
That's right.
That is if we survive week after week because California is having just like a nonstop array of terrible earthquakes.
Oh, my God. Lyle and I have been having a lot of texting about, like,
it's,
are we having an earthquake? Are we having an earthquake? Are we having an earthquake? Most times,
no.
Yes is the answer. Oh, I was going to say most times, yes,
I feel
we are.
Like for, there was a several-hour period where the answer was always yes, and it was shocking because usually the answer is no.
Right.
And I have been texting everyone since wondering about earthquakes, and there haven't been any. So that's been complicated.
I know. We went to the ballet last night, and we were, like, sitting in our seats, and the night before there had been an earthquake. And I heard about somebody who was there that
I
night.
I know someone who was there.
Oh, you were telling me. I think, and the chandeliers were shaking and everything. So, like, we were sitting there, and, like, any sort of, like, if somebody 6 seats down from me, like, moved in their chair,
like,
and I could feel it in
happening.
My chair, I was like, oh, God. Oh,
and
no.
I was saying to Brent, there was one scene where they dropped a chandelier for a very brief scene that was just on one rope. And
on the actual stage.
On the actual stage.
Right.
And it was swinging a little because they had dropped it quickly.
Right.
And I don't even know what happened
just
in
like
that scene.
Just like naturally swinging.
Yeah, just as you would if you had been dropped quickly.
But
from,
for us, considering the last 48 hours that we had had at that point.
I spent that entire scene being like, am I moving? Is the room moving? Right. Where would I go if there was an earthquake? Are the chandeliers moving? Is anyone else looking concerned?
We had a conversation during one of the intermissions about whether our seat was in a place where we would basically just be crushed by rubble or not.
Right, yeah. We were like, are we in the safest or least safe seats? Because we were in a balcony, but we were in the last row of that balcony.
Right.
But the problem
is... So we were like, there's definitely seats above us, but would they fall forward?
Right.
Would they fall
They're pitched forward, so I thought maybe the orchestra would be a worse place to be in.
Right.
But also, if we had escaped the balcony, we would have been in a hallway of mirrors.
Yeah.
Which is not where you want to be. And then that hallway would have exited into a large glass room with chandeliers overhead.
But the first day was really scary because it was just like it had been a while and it was both of them had been long. They're just like real rolling.
It feels like you're on a boat.
Because I felt earthquakes before and they're like over fast. Sometimes they almost like make a bang sound.
Like a truck
and you're
is
like,
going
by. Yeah, you're
something.
Like, oh God, or a gunshot or whatever. And you're like, oh no. And then the ground shakes for like 5 seconds and you're like, fuck, we're having an earthquake.
Right.
But these were like,
these are like 20 second earthquakes.
I had conversations during these earthquakes.
Yeah, well, I had a chance to try multiple places to hide.
Right.
The first earthquake, I was standing at my sink and I'm a person who has in the past fainted. And so I felt the sensation of being about to faint. And I was like, shit.
Yeah.
I just turned my oven on for the first time in 2 years. I'm terrified of my oven because I'm convinced I'll forget to turn it off. And it was a new oven.
Yeah.
And so I had just finally been brave enough to turn it on to make cookies.
Mm-hmm.
And then...
Right. And then now you've got your gas
hits.
On.
Right, exactly. Gas is just on in
billowing
every possible way.
Apartment.
Billowing through my apartment. So I first... I was at this sink when it happened. I first went to turn off my oven... And then I got into the doorway and was like, is this where I should stand? And then turned around and realized I had forgotten to turn off the sink.
Right.
So then I had to go back to the sink. And then I stood in multiple doorways around my house. I only have a couple, by the way, you guys.
Oh, I know. And also, like, I was reading, too. It's
and
like,
you're not supposed to stand in doorways.
Right. Not anymore. Although you might be able to be standing in that doorway because you're only supposed to stand in them if they're load-bearing. Because a lot of, like, new places now, like, the door frames are not actually doing any, like, work.
Right.
Door frame. So they could just, like, very easily just, like, crumble just as much as anything could. But, yeah, like... Friday night, I Literally, I was texting you. There was an article that people were sharing about what to do that the LA Times had written, and yeah. just like about all of the things. Like, I downloaded offline maps of the entire city of Los Angeles in case I like need to escape and there's not cell phone service.
Well, Brent and I actually seriously discussed what our escape route was going to be if they continue.
I have a fire extinguisher in my apartment, and so I got it out.
Right, I made Brent come with me on Saturday to get one,
and we got one for you. Right. I also like put a pair of shoes and socks like next to my bed. I've ordered like a backup battery pack for my
phone
so it could be charged for like 4 days. I bought those lights. That like charge and that'll like run for like
I have
days
one
after.
Manual
I
mean, powered flashlight.
I was in a sheer panic. Yeah. Also, I already have an earthquake kit, but I was just like, that didn't feel like enough at that point.
No. No, it was, and the fact that it happened one day and we thought, oh boy, close call.
Yikes.
And then the next day, it happened again, this time while I was in a Whole Foods, and you don't want to be in the canned food aisle during an earthquake.
Oh yeah, that's right. You were having like shaking...
food
shelves.
Shaking food shelves. And so I ran the entire length of the aisle. By the way, people did not react quickly enough. We had just had one the day earlier, you guys. Everyone could have been a little lighter on their feet.
Right.
So the guy restocking the canned food shelf is like standing in the middle of it blocking everything. So I'm like trying to run around him. In any case, I get to the front and the people at the front were conversing about the earthquake as if it was over, but it was still going on.
Right.
Like I heard one cashier say to another, "Ugh, we're probably not even going to get off early." And then I look up and like the signs are still swinging wildly and the room is shaking and the aisles are waving kind of. And I was like, you guys, we have to wait until it's over before we speculate.
Right. You might not get to go home
from
this job.
Exactly. You might, where are we supposed to stand?
You might die here.
Before we get to the whether we get to go home, where should we stand right now?
Right.
So in any case, that was a mess.
It's crazy. People, especially people from Southern California, or as we mentioned in the rundown, from the USGS.
Right.
The United States Geological Service. Are way too casual about this. And I don't appreciate it like at all. It's interesting though, because like I got to thinking about it and I was like, well, the first thing that you do as a person from Iowa when the tornado alarm goes off is to go to the front porch
and see if you can see the tornado.
Yeah, because you need to see the tornado and you need to see how close it might actually get to your house, which is obviously completely unsafe. And I feel like Southern Californians are like, you know, I was talking to my boyfriend who like grew up here, and it was just sort of like, well, that was a fun California experience. And I was like, no, it fucking wasn't at all.
Yeah. No, I feel the same fear that I felt the time that I was in Oklahoma for a tornado warning and everyone was casually looking outside in a 7-story building just to see if they could see the tornado. And I was like, is there a basement? Can we get to the basement? Right. Where do we go? And they were like, it's only orange. It's not red yet. And I was like, that seems warning-y enough.
Right.
That's how I feel. Well, and also there was a lot of controversy because the earthquake warning system, which is a fake idea in the first place, wasn't working.
Yeah.
And so obviously then there was a big controversy about whether they should lower the threshold, because even though there wasn't really property damage because of the earthquake, because by the time it got to us, it was not that dangerous.
Right. It was like 120 miles away.
Right.
It was just huge.
But it was
like
huge
a 6.6
one there.
And then a 7.1 or something.
When I remember when I first saw pictures, I was like, your liquor store had this kind of damage after that earthquake. And then I was like, this was not nearby.
No.
Thankfully,
it was in a place where there were not many humans.
Yeah. But you know who was there is the USGS, excitedly pursuing the earthquake as if it's like a mystery that they're on the case of.
And excited about future earthquakes and aftershocks.
God. They couldn't be more excited about the future earthquakes. Ugh. They gave a press conference that was the most science nerdy
I didn't watch
bullshit. It was so disturbing to watch because they could not have been more thrilled about this turn of events. They were speculating excitedly about how many more 7.0 or bigger earthquakes we could get in this series, whether the series could extend for months or even years. I mean, they could not get enough of this earthquake situation. They were speculating how much more powerful it could get and how much more powerful it had gotten.
Yeah.
And this whole time, they are experiencing a level of excitement and glee that is not, there is no place for that in any kind of natural disaster, let alone one that strikes without warning that you can't prepare for.
Yeah.
That they were like, we got to get people out there because we really got to look into this. And I was like, don't get people out there. Get everyone away from there. Everyone should be away from there, right? It sounds like a not great place. If there could be 7 more earthquakes for years, then let's not be over there.
Yeah.
Move out of the Bakersfield area and head back this way where it was just make the right choice no matter what. But like head back, go to San Diego.
Yeah.
That's a place where they felt the earthquake, so you could know it was happening, but it wasn't terrifying.
Yeah. Yeah.
But in any case,
oh, man.
What you shouldn't do is have this many earthquakes. If anyone has a phone number.
If anybody's listening.
Of the person that can make this stop.
Yeah.
And is not the USGS, because they want they are very invested in it continuing.
Yeah.
What I want is a United States Geological Survey that is invested in how to stop disasters, right. Not how to continue to be excited for new ones.
Right.
And that was not what they were bringing.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, so the first one was a very patriotic earthquake because it occurred on the 4th of July. Yes. And it occurred basically as Donald Trump was having like a fascist parade.
Right.
While Donald Trump was parading around D.C. in a competing counter-programming event, right. Trying to get Carole King off air, we were experiencing sheer terror. And then Donald Trump's fascist parade took a really confusing turn because he claims his teleprompter went out. I would contend maybe his brain also went out.
Lila took the notes on this particular story, and her first note is Trump's fascist parade took a confusing turn when Trump's teleprompter and or brain went out. And I am seeing that for the first time. And I was like giggling as we were still trying to talk about the earthquake because I had read it while we were talking about the earthquake.
But I mean,
and I was trying not to laugh.
He gave us the greatest meme of the 21st century, I would argue.
I agree.
Because at one point, and he claims this is the moment the teleprompter went out, I would contend this is not a mistake any of us would make.
No.
He's going on about the Continental Army during the Revolutionary War and then goes on, as the teleprompter supposedly goes out, about how they enjoyed taking over things such as the airports during the Revolutionary War.
Right. You know, I would have given him the confusion of battles that happened in the Revolutionary War and that War of 1812. Which he also mixed
up. But who cares or knows?
I was going to say, couldn't
be bothered to care.
Sure, right.
Do it.
You know, he's not a historian. I get that.
Certainly not.
Certainly not. But, like,
if there's one fact about the 1700s to know,
right,
it would be that there was no air travel at the time.
Right, and what is hilarious.
He mentions the Wright brothers.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Like, yes. Besides the fact that you should just know anyway, like, part of that speech was talking about the Wright brothers, like, in 1903 or 1913 or whatever the hell year it was that they started flying. So it's like, if he knew the speech as well as he claims that he did, then just knowing that portion of the speech should have led him to
memorizing
not
a
go
speech
down
and
this.
Memorizing a fact are not the same thing. I think we can prove that.
Yeah.
You'll also be happy to know that there were more people in attendance at his fascist parade than have ever been at any event in the history of time in the world.
Yes.
But these memes were on point. We're going to read you some of them just because it would be unpatriotic of us to allow this to go forward without reading you some stuff from the hashtag Revolutionary War Airport stories or hashtag Revolutionary War Airports series, including one from Andy Tweets. My dearest Meg, I believe we are done for. We have word the French fleet is lost. We can only pray that by God's grace, Washington's men arrive on the red eye from LaGuardia on the morrow, or by noon if there's a connecting flight through Charlotte. Or here's one from Shauna, 1776. Oh, a real historian there.
Uh-huh.
Dearest Martha, please find enclosed a tracking number for my lost luggage in Philadelphia. It shall arrive to Mount Vernon via carriage in 21 to 25 days. Also enclosed is a receipt for the cost of parking my horse at Dulles for the weekend. Or HP Chocolate One tweeted, Abigail, it's hot as hell in Philadelphia. My desire for a quick trip to Boston is thwarted by a connecting flight through Atlanta. It's as if the world has turned upside down. Yours, John. There were some ones also where one guy tweeted, will my emotional support animal require an extra seat? And it's George Washington on his horse.
Yep. Uh-huh.
Or here's another letter one. My dearest Abigail, yesterday we began our assault on Newark International Airport. We lost many brave men near baggage claim, but managed to take the high ground to Concourse B near the Cinnabon. I hope to be coming home soon. Keep an eye on the horizon for my Uber X. Your loving husband, Thomas.
So good.
It was just like a full day of the greatest
I know.
Tweets in history. And to the extent that my mom literally called me like mid-laugh.
Oh, yeah.
To tell me about all of this going on. She was like, did you hear about the thing? And I had heard about the speech, but I hadn't heard about the memes yet. And so I was like, why is she laughing so maniacally about this? And she was like, have you seen the tweets?
So
usually,
good.
You don't want to be the person that's mom has to tell them to look at the tweets, you know?
I know.
But there I was.
You know what? Carla's got her finger on the pulse.
She's got her finger on the pulse. Specifically this pulse.
Pulse.
But also, I feel like this helped me... Because you know I've been saying I'm trying to get back into a state of mind where I can find Donald Trump entertaining.
Yeah, right.
And this was so supremely entertaining. Like, literally couldn't have a discussion about it without like falling into maniacal laughter.
As you said yesterday, you're back in the Trump stakes state of mind.
Yeah, I'm back in the Trump stakes state of mind. It just, I needed this to remind me that, because I think all of us are going to slowly lose our minds if we don't find a way to find humor in all of this.
Yeah.
And I think also we might do it to ourselves because we might guilt everyone into thinking if we're not taking everything so seriously,
That
we're not doing our part.
Right, or we don't think that it's serious.
Right,
like,
obviously not what Brent and I are up to because we literally podcast, we try to weekly.
Right, we know more of the news than almost anyone does, and we are fully understand more than most that it's depressing.
Right, exactly. But I feel like I also needed a moment to remind me of why.
That's why we led.
Why
with that
I loved
story.
Trump's stakes press conference in the first place.
Yeah, right.
And this, I finally. So I think I'm back into the right state of mind to deal with the Trump presidency.
Why I love that Boy Scout speech so much.
Oh my God, that's a great speech.
I forgot about that until literally right this moment, and now
how could you
have forgotten
in the midst?
I've just become much happier than I was 30 seconds ago.
No, there are times in a Trump presidency that are awful. There are also times that you experience more delight than you should.
Right.
And you gotta, people rising to the occasion of this Revolutionary War airport meme.
Yeah. You need to allow yourself to live in those moments.
That's right. When I can't think of anything more patriotic than coming up with a hilarious meme to troll the president. I mean, I feel like America really put forth what is best in all of us in that meme story.
Yeah.
So in any case, keep an eye out for those because they're still coming and they remain funny.
They are.
We also have fundraising numbers.
Yeah.
There's a new fundraising
quarter
deadline.
Two is up, and some people have released their numbers and some
have not.
Haven't.
That's,
yes.
As is always the case.
That's right. Yeah.
But we have the numbers that were released.
Yes.
Huge.
Pete Buttigieg was the first one to say.
Well,
and
he would be.
You would be. Yes.
He raised $24.8 million. He outraised anyone who's announced
else.
So far. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
And with 400,000 donors.
That's a lot.
That's a lot, especially considering that his debate performance was, like, fine, but it wasn't, like, revolutionary or anything.
I know.
It wasn't spectacular.
But he's been, obviously, 400,000 donors is a lot. He has been doing, he has not sworn off the high dollar fundraisers.
Right. Oh,
so he's happy to have a Wall Street fundraiser if there's some big checks involved.
Yeah.
So that's where at least some of that is from. But
well, he's not sworn on to having really clear principles on certain issues that might be affected by this. So that is why he hasn't had to swear off of the fundraisers.
Yeah. But that's going to be huge for him, obviously. I mean,
well,
that's a big
really
number.
Well, it's really legitimizing
I was going to say. And also, it's just like, it's, you know, the size of his campaign is going to be exponentially bigger. He's going to have...
Oh, yeah.
He's going to be able to staff everywhere. I mean, I'm sure he has staff everywhere, but I mean, like, you know...
Yeah, but in the way that a fake candidate might, like, not in the way that, like, Joe Biden should have staff everywhere, but he outraised Joe Biden.
He outraised Joe Biden.
I mean, by quite a bit, considering the numbers that some of the people in the lower end raised.
Yeah,
I mean, he outraised them by more than Michael Bennett raised in the whole quarter.
Right. And by 150,000 donors.
Yeah, which is not surprising.
Not surprising.
But this also is interesting because it's really hard to contend that Joe Biden is the sort of front-running centrist in the race if Pete Buttigieg, who is pretty unabashedly centrist in policy.
On some things, anyway. Yeah, I mean...
On meaningful issues.
Yeah,
I mean, on economic issues, unabashedly centrist. I know he's not as centrist as Joe Biden in that he has a long history of being kind of a dick in various points.
Right.
But if you are a centrist voter, that is the economic policy you're looking for.
Yeah.
Joe Biden is not the strongest centrist candidate in the race if Pete Buttigieg is outraising him in this way.
And this, you know, we talked about this way back in the day when Joe Biden had his first fundraising, you know, his first 24 or 48 or whatever, which was big, but it was like from a lot less donors than at least
was
Sanders
like
was at the time.
Everyone, every Wall Street person he's ever met.
Right. and there were, you know, certainly 21.5 million is a number that you're going to be able to run a good campaign on. He might not be able to because I don't
know. Not everyone
that,
can
that
run a good campaign on any number.
Right. I don't know that he has the ability to. But there was some, you know, chatter on the interwebs this week that was causing some concern because it just wasn't splashy enough. And fundraising has been a concern. It was supposedly one of the concerns of him getting in the race. Like, where was the money going to come from other than a bunch of rich people? He had not ever had to fundraise himself to small dollar donors. He didn't have he sort of like didn't have that kind of appeal that, you know, appeals to a bunch of people, like, you know, writing monthly $30 right. checks to him. And I think this just sort of like goes to prove that. And I think it's when you couple that with what his polls have been doing, which we talked a little bit about last week and we're going to get to
again
more so in just a second. There's some cause for concern going on in the Biden camp right now. And there should be.
There should also, when you come in as this sort of unabashed front runner and you aren't out raising randos.
Right, the mayor of South Bend.
Right, then that is problematic.
You were the two-term vice president.
Exactly. Like, I would expect him to be able to post the highest numbers, even if he was doing nothing.
Right.
Because who are any of these other people? Not the former vice president.
Right, yeah, you know. Exactly.
So Sanders released his numbers. He raised $18 million. He also transferred $6 million from an existing account. So he has $24 million for the second quarter in his accounts.
Yeah.
That's interesting because normally it's... But it was from, like, a million donors.
Yeah, right.
Which is a classic Sanders move. But, I mean, it's nice. Like, I know Warren is not going to have fundraising numbers like Sanders, at least for a while. I also know that it is important that somebody be in the race, even though Sanders is sort of... His situation is waning a little bit. But it's important that someone be in the race with numbers like that that can say, oh, I have a million donors. Like,
right.
Because even Pete Buttigieg raising... Not far from that amount, but with only 400,000 donors. Like, you need someone to help you do the comparative math.
Yes.
And that, it's hard to, like, that means, if he had a million donors, that means that the average donation was $18. That's different than if your average donation for, you know.
Yeah.
I'm certainly not going to do the math here, but it's like, sounds like it's like $400-ish or something like that. For Pete Buttigieg, like, it's hundreds of dollars in Pete Buttigieg's case. And obviously some people give small donations and some don't.
Yeah, of course.
But it is always nice when someone is in the race with a big enough number that you can do some math.
Yeah, right.
Where you're like, exactly.
I can divide
18 by a million, 18 million by a million, and then I can realize that there are small dollars going into Bernie Sanders' campaign.
Yeah.
And then, so Kamala Harris raised $12 million. That's not, it was a good showing for her.
It was much better than she did
sped
in,
up.
Right, I was going to say it was much better than she did in Q1. And as we know, because I believe we talked about it last week, within either the first 24 or 48 hours, she had at least a couple million dollars. So this is accounting for a whole quarter here. And if you consider that a good chunk of that money came in, you know, one batch
foul swoop
of time, right, after the debates, then that's, I think, and also knowing how she's been doing in the polls, again, we're going to get there, and we talked about some last week, that I assume will probably also continue to sort of like tick up.
She's also another good benchmark against which to compare Biden's fundraising because she actually had more donors than him.
Right. And half the money.
Right. So that I feel
and
like
look,
this many
rich people are not afraid to write Kamala Harris a check either.
No, she's not afraid to hear them. She's not afraid to take an audience with them.
Yeah.
So we're like, I think that the Biden numbers are going to start to tell a different story than they really want them to tell, because by comparison, all of these people, and listen, I know he's not going to have fundraising numbers like Bernie Sanders, who is not taking big checks from Wall Street.
Right.
But it does feel like if even Kamala Harris is raising money for more people and getting less money for it, then where is Biden's money coming from?
I know. Right.
It's not a great look.
Yeah. No.
Michael Bennett released his numbers, $2.8 million. I don't know why we're talking about Michael Bennett ever.
Right?
I mean,
where'd that come from?
Probably one friend of his. Can't imagine. Steve Bullock raised $2 million. Steve Bullock didn't even qualify for the first debate.
I know.
You know, Steve Bullock is another white guy that you won't recognize if he gets into one of the other debates.
How did he not get into the debate if in the last quarter he made $2 million? There's no way that didn't come from more than 65,000 people.
Or is there? Also, he's not...
No, because I think you max
it was
out.
Either
don't
or.
Don't you max out at like $2,800?
But wasn't
or something
it Q1
like that?
Fundraising that qualified them for the first debate?
I think it was just up until like a cutoff point before the first debate.
Oh, maybe. But
which was only 3 weeks ago. That's why I'm saying if he made $2 million, there's no way it's just surprising to me.
Maybe
unless that all came recently.
But that
doesn't make sense because.
Who's been hearing about
Steve
Bullock?
Bullock recently? No one.
I mean, it's wild.
But anyway, so we sort of talked about what some of those takeaways are. We certainly talked about what the Biden takeaway is. There's a little bit of supposed hand-wringing and you can never tell from the mainstream press whether this is just hogwash or not, but within the Sanders camp about those numbers, because again, it was okay. They had to move some money from another account. And also he is sort of like known as this big fundraising juggernaut. And also he's been lagging in the polls, which is our next story.
Well,
so
he's, I feel like, doing what I would expect him to be in there doing those still. I think, you know, if you're working on the Sanders campaign, you obviously have to have a different mentality than this.
Right, you're trying
you're
to win.
You're trying to win the race. Right. If you are someone who's thinking, what role can Sanders play in this campaign? And is that, you know, maybe that role is as someone who can end up polling well and win, but that role serves a purpose no matter what.
Yeah.
Because that role is why we're having a debate in the party about a number of issues that wouldn't have come up if it weren't for him.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like I don't expect him to perform like he did last time against one candidate who stood in sort of an abashedly Biden-esque position.
Right.
So I don't expect, I mean, there's a lot more money, there's a lot more people to donate money to in this level of the race.
Yeah.
And also, Sanders is not, I don't think, ever going to be a flavor of the month in this race, whereas Buttigieg is certainly a flavor of the month at the moment. And that, maybe he'll stay a contender, but he could also just as easily not.
Right.
Because he certainly, as far as experience goes, has far less than anyone else in the field. And that could eventually kind of come to play.
Yeah.
Especially when they start talking about records. He has some issues in his own community with the minor amount of things you would have to deal with as the mayor of South Bend.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think we're, and he's not polling in the top tier. He's sort of been hovering near it, basically.
Yes.
But, so this, so.
Well, and he's been sagging in the, we're talking about Buttigieg.
Yeah, Buttigieg,
right
yeah.
Now. Yeah,
no,
and
he's
lagging.
Been lagging
because
in the polls.
He had a moment where he was in,
that's
like,
where, like,
in a log jam in third right now.
I think that his fundraising haul is probably because he was flavor of the month last month.
Oh, I think
is what I'm saying.
So.
Yeah, and
yeah.
I think
no,
Sanders
I think
is not going to be the flavor of the month any month.
Right.
Because we already know his deal.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
He's either going to lose support to people like Warren or he's not.
Right.
But either way, he's still pulling in the top tier and he's still fundraising in the top tier. So it's like they can stop hand-wringing, in my opinion. No, that's just my opinion.
Yeah. So there are a bunch of new polls out in this last week.
Exciting
some
ones.
Further sort of like, you know, fallout from the debate, and also
just from generalness.
Right, exactly. And there was a new poll that came out in Iowa that has Warren ahead.
Surprise.
And by the
way,
slow and steady, and also maybe not so much of a surprise, because sort of just at least flipping back to fundraising, we don't know exactly how much money she made, but there's also smart ways to use the money that you get too. I mean, on some level, like, sure, would you rather have $24 million? Yes. But if you only raise six, then you got to figure out where the hell you wanted to go to, as opposed to just sort of throwing it into the wind. And I was just reading, actually, it may have even been in the same story where I pulled these poll numbers from, is that she has more staff in Iowa than anyone, and it's not close.
Yeah.
It's like a country mile.
Well, she
ahead.
Probably
and
saw
because,
what that did for Sanders.
Right, exactly. So it's her, you know, it's close. She's not blowing people out, but it's the first time that I've seen this anyway, at least.
It's the first time she's been ahead, and Harris is actually in second
now. Yeah, she is at 20, Harris is at 18, Biden is at 17. I believe those three are all within the margin of error. And then Sanders is at 12%. And that is a 12% uptick for Warren since the same poll in March. And I didn't see how much of a drop that was for Biden since March, but they took this poll back in September, which, granted, is too early to take a poll because, come on, guys. I mean, that's cuckoo bananas.
Right.
But at that time, it was Biden 37-12 over Sanders. Yeah. So, I mean, it's over a pretty long amount of time, but, like, that's a huge plummet for Biden there, too, which, guess what? It's because he's barely freaking been there.
Yeah.
And, like, that's just stupid because, like, you gotta go to the places who are gonna vote and elect you. Like, just, that's just what you do. But also,
don't miss,
like,
Iowa if you're Biden.
I was gonna say, like, if you're, unless you're gonna decide to skip it.
Right.
Which there have been people who done
that would
over
be a
the years.
Bananas
and
choice to make if you're a centrist candidate.
Right. And I don't think that he's going to do that. But it's like, Iowa more so than almost all of the other places, you've got to be smart enough, if you're him, to know that the only way that somebody's going to vote for you is if they get a personal audience with you.
Yeah.
And, you know, you and I have talked about how that is annoying to you, and I get it.
Sure.
But it's also
true.
The reality in which we're living in.
Yeah.
So it's like to not be hanging out there. I mean, Marianne Williamson literally bought a condo there,
yeah,
which is crazy, but, like, that's a thing that people are up to. So to just decide to, you know, be chilling wherever it is you are and talking about Donald Trump being a bad person and maybe showing up at a debate, like, that is not a recipe for winning Iowa.
No, but it is the kind of recipe that someone who is sort of cavalier about whether they should have to try to be the president right. would have.
Yeah.
Because
it's also apparently not a great strategy to even
win America.
Win America, because he's now barely winning in some national polls. We talked about some last week.
And Warren is hot on his heels.
Yes, because she's in second in the latest Economist YouGov poll, which is, again, was a huge dip for him and a huge wave for her. It's 23 Biden, 19 Warren, Harris not far behind, and 15%, and then Sanders is at 9%.
Yeah.
And you sort of hit this a bit ago, but I think you've got, much like we sort of talked last week about how you could almost see a very clear correlation between the bottoming out of Biden's poll numbers and the rise of
Harris's.
You really sort of, and there's no way to prove that this is what happened, but there's no...
Just
there's
know that we're right and don't worry
no
about it.
There's no way to not think
facts.
That Sanders people did not just flip to Warren's people, because those are almost exact flips.
Yep.
I mean...
No, and it makes sense. And I think... I've been thinking this the whole time. Like, I think that when you... It makes sense to think about the field in camps insofar as ultimately people will filter out. And really what we're looking for is a sense of who is looking for what kind of leadership.
Oh, yeah.
The
and we talked about that at the beginning of this primary before half these people had even announced that there were going to be sort of...
Camps.
There's going to be like micro primaries.
Yeah. And that's... Basically. They're in a micro primary. They know it. That,
right.
They're
exactly.
Fools, you know.
And Biden and Harris are
right.
In
and
one.
Sort of. Harris is sort in a of. Weird primary she, because she's in the sort of trendy person and the centrist primary.
But
she's in all
Biden
the primaries.
Biden and Buttigieg are definitely in.
Absolutely. They're in a similar primary, and that primary includes the Amy Klobuchars and all of these generic white people. And, you know, Harris is in a sort of trendy person primary. She's currently winning that primary because that primary has all the young, cool senators like, you know, Cory Booker and Kirsten Gillibrand and like those kind of people. And all of them are centrists, by the way.
Right.
But they're in a slightly different primary than Biden.
Yeah.
But, and ultimately their primary will, the real question I think will be, are we looking for centrist or progressive leadership, and they're going to try to tack to both sides at once.
Yeah.
That's what that primary is about. And that's what Harris has been trying to do.
Yeah.
Now, we're going to talk in a little bit about how sometimes she fails to do it well.
Right.
But, you know, I feel like the sort of general primary, you know, field that we're looking at here is still very much divided into micro primaries. And so that's why we're able to see exact flips in certain micro primaries, and also that's what we'll ultimately see as larger trends. Like we'll know who's voting in which primary, and then we'll know what's going on. Meanwhile,
oh my gosh,
Biden.
This is so good.
Here's the thing: Joe Biden is a man who is really, really bad at apologizing.
Right,
the
we
worst.
We saw him give the world's worst apologies about Anita Hill.
They weren't apologies.
They were. I think that he thinks.
I think he thinks that apologizing is apologizing to people for them being mad at you and not for your actions.
Right.
It's like when you're dealing with someone who says they're sorry, you're upset all the time. And you're like, I'm upset because you were an asshole. Are you sorry for that? Or are you just sorry I'm upset after you don't feel bad about acting like an asshole? And that's kind of what he keeps doing.
Yeah.
I would contend this goes so far as to be triggering for a lot of women, I would argue, because this is what it's like to be a woman in the world and what it's like to be a person of color a lot of the time, as Joe Biden is proving. But it's like people not actually apologizing to you for being dicks. It's them apologizing for the fact that you're upset.
Yeah, because
it's infantilizing.
Right. So here's exactly what he said. Yeah. When he was asked about it, he said, was I wrong a few weeks ago?
But it being the comment, the argument about, he had with Kamala Harris during the debate about busing.
The debate about busing and whether he should have been talking about working, about how great and wonderful the segregation is.
The segregationists were.
Yeah. He said, was I wrong a few weeks ago? Yes, I was. I regret it. Here's the good part, though. And I'm sorry for any of the pain of misconception that caused anybody.
He's sorry you misunderstood his words, you guys.
I'm sorry about the misconception that you had about both my record and what I've been saying.
Right. I'm sorry that my words construed a point that you interpreted to mean what I said as opposed to what I feel that I meant in retrospect. Like, this is, like, just say, yes, I was, I regret it.
Done, period.
Done, period. End of sentence.
Success.
New paragraph. Like, it's every time, even when he accidentally apologizes with words that are apologetic, he tacks something on that unapologizes.
Yeah.
That is like patronizing.
Also, right. And that is partly because, probably in large part, because he's patronizing.
Correct.
It's also in large part because he's very much a man who doesn't know when to shut his mouth.
Yeah, and those are the defining qualities of his political career. And it's often
the extra accidental things that get you into trouble.
Lest we forget, this is a man famous for huge gaffes.
Yeah.
That's what he does.
Yeah.
That's why he's never been the president, you guys.
That's right.
He's either talked about or actually run for president every campaign of my lifetime. And Brent's lifetime. And Brent is 2 years older than me. And every single one of those times, he is a man who has made himself an untouchable candidate by either making a gaffe before he announces or making a gaffe after he announces.
Yeah, or plagiarizing somebody.
I mean, he's up to gaffing. Whatever. It's a gaffer.
Right.
Not the lighting kind, but
he's not carrying around tape.
He doesn't have any tape. He's not dealing with equipment. He's right. A man who professionally makes gaffes.
Yeah.
And he will continue to. And this is a gaffe.
Yeah.
But more concerningly.
Another thing I think this is really concerning, and I don't know that he would necessarily consider it a gaffe, because I think he was probably just being honest, although I guess that's sort of what gaffes can be. But regardless, and we, again, touched on this a little bit last week, saying, like, the fact that he did not see that coming, that attack from Harris at the debate, was shocking, and he basically admitted this week to he did not see it coming.
That he was prepared for candidates to make him the focal point. He was prepared to be the star.
Right.
But he wasn't prepared for anyone to attack his record.
Right.
Basically.
And that is so it surprised it to me for a few reasons. And one being she had done it earlier in the week already. Right.
One being that she had already basically announced her plan to attack him for this by doing it.
Right. Exactly.
And so it wasn't a surprise to anyone.
Right. And the other being the fact that it made more sense for her to attack him than any of the other 9 people on the stage. I mean,
someone had to.
So if you're looking at the list of people who you're standing up there with and you think, why might Michael Bennett attack me? No, that doesn't track.
Pete Buttigieg, probably
Marianne
not.
Marianne Williamson, well, she's just the kook on the end, so maybe, but nobody will care. Kamala Harris, no, it won't be her. Huh?
Of course it will be her.
Yes, it will be her.
She's running in your primary, because she's running in all the primaries. And she has a specific issue she's already dinged you for earlier in the week.
Right, and that should scare you, A, for its sheer stupidity.
Right.
And also, he is banking his whole candidacy on the fact that he is the best person to take on Trump.
Yeah.
Who is just an attack monster.
Exactly.
And so if you are going to stand up there on a debate stage and not see an attack coming that all of Earth saw coming.
Right.
And
well,
then,
because it
and
was
then
announced
we, and then we,
rehearsed.
And then we want to put you in a general election against Donald Trump, of all people, and think that you're an acceptable person to be able to battle back against that.
Not a chance.
You're not. I mean, I feel like it's... Like, this statement, almost more than any of the others, I feel like is just, should be disqualifying for him.
No,
because
I agree.
It really concerns me.
It's like too stupid.
If he wins this primary, I'm scared because of this specific thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm scared for other reasons, too. But, like, this should be alarming to you.
This is exactly what we had that made it impossible for us to handily defeat Donald Trump in the first place is a campaign that wasn't ready to react and didn't know what to do with the attack monster.
Yeah.
this is, and Biden is even worse at it than Clinton would have been, or Biden will be worse at it than Clinton was
too.
By an amount that I can't even express in words. Like, and you guys know that I have my issues with Hillary Clinton. I have been clear about that from the beginning of this podcast. I've been clear about that since long before she was the candidate.
Yeah.
But I don't have anything in the way of issues with her when compared to the issues I have with Joe Biden's inability to be an effective communicator in a situation
like
this.
Well, I was just about to say, like, if there was one thing that she sort of often was in that campaign was quick on her feet in an attack from him.
Yeah, she can debate you. She's a smart lady. She's not somebody who can't deal with your fucking debate.
Right.
Like, she's somebody who can't campaign in front of a crowd.
Sure.
But she could certainly, she had no trouble in the debates with him.
Yeah.
And, you know, in terms of what she was trying to sell to the people that would have voted for her. This guy would, though.
Yeah. And it just shows that you're bad at politics.
And with Donald Trump, you can't even be prepared for an attack.
Well, that's the
thing. Attacks come from everywhere. So you can't, like, this is like an obvious attack that basically she announced her intention to do, rehearsed it in public, and then came and did it on national television after everyone had already heard the attack.
Right.
And we'd been talking about it all week.
Right.
And he wasn't prepared for that. How is he going to be prepared for an attack that truly comes out of thin air?
I know.
Of course, then Harris ruined everything.
Oh my God. This is hilarious.
This is just classic Kamala Harris.
This is just like her because it's basically a version of what she's been doing with Medicare for All since the beginning of this campaign.
She's the queen of the backtrack.
Because if we think back to specifically what she was attacking him for, it was, yes, working with the segregationists. But as we sort of, I think, just said last week, is that it was because she was. The segregationist thing was a gift to her because she was always going to go after him about busing.
Right.
Like that was because that's part of his record. She's been sitting on that since probably the beginning of the campaign, just waiting to be in the same room with him to use it. And specifically what she was going for was that he didn't think that there should be mandatory busing.
Right.
And that it should be left basically to communities to decide who was getting bused to whatever school district.
Right.
And she said at the time, but school districts weren't integrating. So it was the job of the federal government to step in and force them to do it. So she got asked about it this week.
As you would.
As you would, as a person who just attacked someone and made millions of dollars and leaped into second place or first place in a bunch of polls, what she actually thinks about busing. And you want to know what she said? She thinks the exact same fucking thing about Joe Biden does about busing.
Should be left to the states.
Can you believe it?
I can only believe it because she's done it twice on Medicare for All. Because otherwise, I cannot believe it.
Yeah.
Because, first of all, this would imply a few things. One, it would imply that she thinks there's an acceptable amount of integration in our current public school system, which we all know is a complete crock of shit. The schools are not only not integrated, but in some communities are even more segregated than they used to be.
Yeah.
And also, the funding for them is very unevenly distributed because that's something we've also left to communities.
Right.
And so this is not, if she's trying to claim to me that this is a problem that we've moved past since it's not the civil rights era anymore, I call bullshit on that.
Right. And I think she's already tried to backtrack this, of course, because that's another classic move.
It's an amount of backtracking that you shouldn't have to do on an issue that you're trying to make your signature argument.
Oh, God.
But why can't she be prepared the first time?
Yeah, it's like if you go, and this again is just, it's basically what I just said about Biden. It's being bad at politics.
Yeah, because
and that is one thing that you're going to have to be good at in a general election.
Yeah.
Because Donald Trump is the idiot that he is, but he's a man who understands the human imagination. The human imagination, and also just like, if there's one thing that he's good at, it's just like the political nature of
this. He's got a lizard-like quality that allows him to sort of succeed against all odds in political environments.
And he will have
because he's impervious to any political concerns.
And he will have a field day with something like this.
We're having a field day with it.
Right.
I can't imagine what kind of field day he would have with it.
Yeah.
She'd have a nickname. It would be very entertaining,
so
but
she's
awful.
She's got to start doing better.
Yeah.
I mean, we've been saying that for a while. And so she could start at any moment.
That's right. If she listens to this podcast, just know that this is already 4 months too late to be doing better, but never too late to try.
That's right.
Start anytime.
Right.
And we've been saying this since the Medicare for All backtracking began.
I only care about the people doing better who might end up winning.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like, I don't...
Right, everyone else can... Like, I don't care if Michael Bennett does better or worse.
He was the example that I was just about to use.
He's the official example of someone...
Whatever
he
wants.
Pleases. Yeah.
And I'll be happy about it.
John Delaney,
about it, I don't care.
Could literally do anything.
Right. But it's like, you know, we're now living in a world where maybe Kamala Harris becomes the nominee, and I need her to not be having this be what she's up
to. Well, and it also makes me worry because she is someone who has a kind of troubling attorney general's record for California.
Yeah.
She was in favor of three strikes. She's, you know, been in favor of some policy that has caused mass incarceration in ways that we really should be trying to move away from.
Yeah.
For things that don't matter. And so... That has not really entered the the conversation yet because right. it's something that only people in California are aware of. And even a lot of people in California aren't aware of it because who knows what the Attorney General of California is up to. But that's like, if this is the kind of mishap she's making over an issue that she has been sitting on
yeah.
or the most important issue in the race, because I would contend that healthcare is one of the primary issues in this race. Everyone yeah. should have a well-conceived idea of where they stand on that at this
know,
point.
Right. And even no if you excuse. Don't have a good idea, you have to know what the definition of Medicare for right. all
you
just, is.
You have to know what the idea that you have, even if it's not good, is.
right.
But I mean, the third strike for her,
yeah.
no, to bring back to the three strikes metaphor,
well done.
I think could be that she's not prepared to address her record as Attorney General.
Yeah.
Because she's a really good debater, but she's not good on the she's not good on the offense.
Yeah.
For the political offense, yeah. like you're saying. You know, she's great if you can get her into, but she seems like maybe someone who's willing to argue any point for the sake of winning the debate.
right, right. Yeah.
Like, don't you have that impression now that she's yeah. kind of backed away from what, yeah. why was she so incensed at him if she ultimately holds the same position to yeah. win the debate?
Yep.
And she did, so good for her, but like,
yeah.
you gotta have more than that. Meanwhile, the census is an issue that won't die.
Oh my God, we thought it was dead. We told you about the Supreme Court ruling, and then on Monday,
they said they weren't going to pursue a citizenship question.
But then Trump tweeted something about like, just kidding.
Right.
I don't know
we're
why
doing
they,
it anyway.
I don't know why they said that we weren't going to pursue it because we are indeed going to pursue it. But it's unclear as to how they're pursuing it because they missed a deadline to give a better reason.
Well, they didn't have a better reason. So how are they going to give a reason they didn't have?
Yeah.
I think they purposely missed that deadline so that they could say, we missed yeah. the deadline and that's why you don't yeah. have a reason, and not
yeah.
tell us that the reason what the reason is and have us discover it was dumb.
Yeah. So they apparently the Department of Commerce and Justice have been instructed to examine whether there is a path forward consistent with the Supreme Court's decision that would allow for the inclusion of the citizenship question on the census. But guess what? There isn't a path forward, and there might be a path forward. But whatever that
path
forward,
path.
Well, I was going to say that whatever that path forward is will not be consistent with the Supreme Court's decision.
No, because the Supreme Court's decision was that you can't do it.
Just told them not to.
Right. That's yeah. The path forward, according, well, Trump says there's four or five ways they could do it. Now, he's a man who believes in the possibilities.
Sure.
We could say that about
him.
He's
a dreamer.
He's a dreamer. So they floated an executive order, which right. is the fascist way to do it.
Sure.
They've floated adding it as an addendum, so printing out
right.
a secondary
printing
questionnaire.
Has started.
Right, it's yeah. over. It's not over, but like the printing, the decision yeah. about what to put on the printed version of the census is over.
Yeah.
But I love the idea of them trying to send out a second census that just asks
right.
if you're a citizen.
Are you a citizen?
As if anyone would answer that right. census question.
I know.
Because that's a great way to have nobody return that questionnaire.
I know.
Like, I wouldn't return a questionnaire that just asks if I'm a citizen.
Yeah.
I have a fucking social security number. They can just look me up if yeah. they want to know I'm a citizen.
A lot of people, and I feel like this is what I am, the theory that I'm now ascribing to also, is that are thinking that if they can just continue to say nonsense like this, that they can basically, like, scare up an undercount.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that that's what...
I think they're going to scare up the opposite.
Well, I mean, I hope so, and I sort of feel like that's the case, but I do think that if, like, it's their intent to continue speaking about it in this way until
yeah.
the point where people literally are having people knock on their
right,
doors
and are
telling
afraid
them to
open their census,
then I think maybe they could potentially be onto something.
Yeah.
I hope that by the time 2020 rolls around, we will know that it's not on there. There won't be an addendum. There isn't an executive order, and we will have already sort of, like, tried this in the media,
yeah.
and it'll be over. But I think that their plan is to just sort of, like, carry on talking about it, which
maybe.
Is like, if you're a person who is here with undocumented and there's enough confusion on
yeah.
your part,
yeah.
then you may be inclined to not fill out the census. I think that's probably what they're trying to do.
Oh, I'm sure that that's it. I am hoping that what they are instead doing is, like, electing Doug Jones, essentially. Like, I'm hoping that what they're doing instead is making everyone learn a lot about the census.
Right.
Because this is pretty far out for us to
yeah.
already be starting this process. And that gives people the option to just put their head in the sand and not want to deal with it.
Oh, yeah.
But, like, you were saying, like, your boyfriend
yeah.
is involved already in doing
oh,
census
yeah.
outreach. A lot of groups are, especially in communities that are traditionally undercounted.
I explained the census to people who had no idea what it was in
right.
numbers that I was surprised at. And,
I think
June
at the end,
of, or
by,
July
at,
of 2019.
In 2020, everyone in America is going to have an incredibly detailed amount of knowledge about what the census
what the
is and why
is.
We fill it out. And I don't think... I think they keep trying these strategies. It's like,
yeah.
You know, they try this as well. We had a blue wave in the midterms after we were basically told that would be impossible and that will never happen and no one will right. actually show up and whatever. They're trying this a lot, this strategy of just scaring us into totally. Doing nothing.
Yeah.
And what it's doing instead is agitating everyone. And everyone already feels so anxious and frustrated
yeah.
that it feels like it's going to become less effective over time to scare people in this way into yeah. not doing simple things.
Yeah.
I don't think that we're going to scare everyone into having an 800 million person march on Washington or something.
Right.
But I think we could easily scare everyone into becoming educated about the census to the extent that those of us that live in communities with undocumented people, because it's not, you know, there are undocumented people all over the country, but there are pockets of undocumented people in certain communities that they are specifically
right.
targeting an undercount. And those communities are communities like where we live.
Yeah.
They're cities and
yeah.
places where, you know, border states and border cities and things like that. I think if we sort of this early on are like, okay, in the city of Los Angeles, everyone is going to understand the census.
Yeah.
Then this, you know, they'll probably undercount people in other places that they shouldn't. But I mean, we won't lose seats in that kind of a method.
Right.
You know, and
yeah.
some other places could stand to lose a few seats at this point. I mean, Jesus Christ, exactly. people are making terrible choices.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, we're not at an impeachment place, but we are taking some new actions to try to get these tax returns.
Yeah.
The House Ways and Means Committee filed a lawsuit on Tuesday to enforce the subpoenas that the White House has already defied
right.
To release Donald Trump's tax returns.
Yes.
I don't know how this ends.
I kind of don't.
I feel like the courts are not enough. At a certain point, you can change the law.
Well, and yes. And also, there has been a lot of, I think when this finally happened this week, there was a huge sigh of relief because even though, as you said, who knows where this ends, but like people had been getting really antsy with Richard Neal, who's the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, because he asked nicely once
right.
and then subpoenaed them, which was... the subpoena was ignored. But the House Ways and Means can get somebody's tax returns.
Right. They don't need to go through this method.
Right.
They have to just show that it's sort of in the course of a legitimate investigation, which it is.
Yes.
Because we now have an amount of evidence about the president's actions that would indicate that he has committed impeachable offenses.
Yes. I mean,
that is another thing, though, that it might be nice to start a fucking impeachment hearing.
Right.
So that we could have some reason to start making some moves here.
Yeah.
But I mean, we're past the point of asking politely.
Yeah.
Once the White House has defied your subpoena and you're having to go to court to get the president's tax returns that he should have released in the first place.
Yeah.
The man's not going to give us his tax returns.
No.
But the tax returns were submitted to the U.S. government, which we are.
Right.
So it seems like that can't be our only
which
way in.
Which is why they can have them.
Exactly. That can't be our only way in. They are literally charged with oversight.
Yeah. Yeah.
The House Ways and Means Committee is charged with exactly this kind of oversight.
Yeah.
This is what they have to do.
Yeah.
I have a personal theory, which might be controversial.
Uh-huh.
I don't think Charlie Rangel would have put up with this bullshit in the same way. Remember when he was the head of the House Ways and Means Committee and they were up to shenanigans?
Yeah.
And listen, he was a fat cat lining his pockets with shady deals in the neighborhood or whatever. I get it. I once met with his office.
Yeah.
In the early days of StyHealth. Uh-huh. And I was blown away by that meeting because we had done meetings all day with all these staffers who were like 22 and had no idea what was going on and didn't give a shit about us and whatever.
Yeah.
And we went into his office and we met with a guy in his 60s who had been with Charlie Rangel since the dawn of time.
Right.
They knew exactly what they were talking about.
Yeah.
They were very serious with us in the meeting and very informative. We sort of told them what we wanted. They were very straight with us about it. They were obviously going to support legislation,
yeah,
but
sure.
we were going because there was competing legislation. We were trying to sort of filter out the better legislation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But that office did not fuck around. Like some of these people who've been in office for a long time just amass nonsense people in their offices.
Sure.
But I feel like some of them amass, like I feel the same way with Jerry Nadler's office. Like there are people who've been there for a really long time and they're really effective.
Yeah.
And I kind of felt that way about his office. Hmm. And listen, I don't know Neil's office that well. I can't say whether he also has a bunch of, but I would take a bunch of no-nonsense New Yorkers over literally anybody in this moment.
Right.
Because whatever's happening now is a bunch of nonsense.
Yeah.
Like, this is BS.
Yeah. I love Jay Sekulow, the president's attorney, said, we will respond to this latest effort at presidential harassment in court.
I just can't. The victim, the victim mentality with
so
them is
good.
Hilarious.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Justin Amash left the GOP this week.
Yeah, he did.
He was just like, never mind for this.
Probably because he's going to run for president as an independent, which...
I mean, do whatever you want.
Do that.
Go ahead. And this is like a man who was one of the founding members of the Freedom Caucus.
Yeah.
He's a man who feels like the party has gotten too extreme because they are too in the pocket of Trump, even though he helped found an extremist group of congresspeople who were there just specifically like, to stop anything all legislation from happening. And now he's resigning because the hyper-partisanship has created an environment where Congress has no power.
Right.
Which is true. But it started with his own caucus.
You took power away from your own party.
Right. It began with the Tea Party. Right. The Freedom Caucus is the beginning of this story.
Yeah.
He's younger than I thought, though. He's only 39, which is, I don't know how I feel about that. Good or bad. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
He's kind of a libertarian. I think that's why he's feeling so... He just wants there to be no government, which is a conflicting opinion to have when you're in government, but what are you going to do?
Yeah.
But so I think he's probably angry, rightfully, because they keep spending so much fucking money. The Republicans these days.
Well, yeah, that's
because they're
true.
In the pocket of Trump, and he's just a guy who wants small government and no spending and to have nobody have anything nice. And if you're a person who wants no one to have anything nice and you're seeing most people having nothing nice and then a bunch of people having really nice things, then you're probably like, I don't know. Is this what I signed up for?
Right.
I wanted to live in a bunker with no one around. And it sounds sort of like Donald Trump now
and
owns
not because
everything.
I had to.
No.
But by choice.
That was my choice because of freedom. In any case, so he's funny because he wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post about this, and it was on the 4th of July, but he basically thinks that all of those great patriotic Freedom Caucus people are gone, and now he feels so alone.
Mm, yes.
And part of it is because, Jim Jordan and, what's-his-face, not Tim Meadows, Mark Meadows. Tim Meadows was a cast member on Mad TV. Mark Meadows are, like, the sort of big guns of the Freedom Caucus and are in Trump's pocket pretty deeply.
Yeah.
And so he's sort of like, because the Freedom Caucus then censured him right after he declared that we should consider impeaching Trump.
Oh, yeah, right.
So already his friends were on the outs with him, and they've been sitting at different lunch tables this whole time. But he's now the only independent in the House.
Oh, well, that's kind of fun.
Which is exciting, I guess. I mean, he's a Freedom Caucus member, so he's not exactly independent in the way of, he's not, Senator King.
No, he's not.
Of Maine, who's independent for bizarre reasons that you don't really know where he stands on anything.
Right.
Angus King is his own guy.
Yeah.
Justin Amash is his own guy, but not in the greatest way.
No.
And in any case, in final news, we bring you the most important information that we could possibly give you. And we realize this is an hour into the podcast, but you're going to want to listen to every moment of this, no matter how long we go on.
Yeah. You know, we have talked a lot about how we are people who know who Marianne Williamson is as people who live in Southern California.
Right.
And people have been sort of confused about where she was spawned from. And there is an amazing article in the New York Times this week. And it's long.
And we're going to tell you every detail of it.
We're basically going to read it to you.
It's important.
I took the notes on this one. And I was like,
they're not notes.
I don't know what I'm like.
So
what
much
do
as.
What do I take out?
He basically just wrote every sentence of the article in a new line.
So we could read it.
So that we could read it more easily.
Right. Yeah.
But in any case,
it's important to know where she came from.
And we didn't know.
We knew all of this. Right. We knew who.
We knew about the Course in Miracles.
Right. And we knew who she is. We know who she is now.
Right.
And we have known
for a
while.
We know she ran for Congress in this area. We know that she once got into an argument about abortion with my mom on the Nation Cruise.
We know a lot of people who have been to her lectures on the Course in Miracles.
Some of them too excitedly. I have received some very specific emails from her campaign supporters asking me to consider joining the light.
Yep. Yes.
I have been unhappy about that.
Yeah.
But the Course in Miracles has beginnings that we didn't know to expect.
No. Yeah, you've got to sort of start at the beginning here, which is the actual book, A Course in Miracles.
Yeah.
Which I knew that she did not write it. She's often...
even know that much.
She often gets credited as writing it, but she has basically just sort of written on it.
It's very like Mormonism, where Joseph Smith found the Book of Mormon under a rock and claims to not have written it and was in fact illiterate.
It is.
But it's almost exactly like that.
Yeah, the hardcore devotees of this consider it to be one of the Gospels.
Yes. And in the sense that Jesus Christ is a person that is part of their belief system.
Yes, because the woman who's responsible for the book, her name is Helen Schuckman?
Schuckman.
Right?
She's Jewish.
Right.
She's a New York Jew.
Right. Her parents were non-practicing Jews.
I want to clarify. The Times says to clarify that they weren't Orthodox.
Right, but they
everyone is a non-practicing Jew. Right. They were Jewish people in New York. Right. Helen Schuckman.
Right.
Or Schuckman. Yeah. She was at NYU getting a degree in psychology.
Right, exactly. And as an adult, she began having some strange experiences.
That's right.
She had a vivid dream, a lot of vivid dreams, right. But in one she found herself in a dim cave. Unfurling a mysterious scroll. And once, while riding the subway.
I love that it goes from a dim cave with a mysterious scroll to the subway.
Yeah, which is a dim cave.
So true.
Really, I mean. She saw her fellow passengers glow in holy light.
How did she know the light was holy?
I don't know.
You see a lot of weird things in the subway.
I was going to say, couldn't somebody just been backlit or like, I mean,
there's weird stuff going on in the subway all the time.
Yeah, for sure.
Sometimes people breakdance in the subway. That's a little unexpected. I mean, you don't know what's going on there.
Right. But then the biggie came in 1965 because she was working as a research psychologist at Columbia Presbyterian Medical Center and she heard a voice address her and it urged her to take dictation.
Mm-hmm.
And it said, this is a course in miracles. Please take notes.
Here's the thing. Your psychologist is definitely as crazy as you.
Always.
If you ever doubted that fact, this story is proof that anyone who studies psychology is a little nuts.
Yeah. Anyway, she ultimately came to believe that this voice belonged to Jesus.
Just a quick side note. Just to remind you, this is a Jewish woman in New York who decided that a voice that she heard in her own head for some reason belonged to Jesus, a figure that doesn't exist in her theoretical religious background.
Yeah. Anyway, her spirit channeling went over like 3 years. Or multiple years, and it came out, 3 volumes, 1,300 pages.
Wow. That is a lot of pages.
And it was published in 1976 by the Foundation for Inner Peace.
That sounds like exactly... Well, there's like a lot... Here's some background on the general scene. New York State is like where you go to start a cult. It's cult central.
Yeah.
The Book of Mormon was found under a rock in upstate New York. If the Oneidas are from New York, if you are a person who's interested in cults... And you are a person who wants to visit all the great cult founding locations. All you have to do is literally take a trip up the Hudson River. The Erie Canal and the Hudson River are like the founding banks of every cult in American history. Amazing. And including ones you don't associate.
Yeah. So this book drew from older traditions like Christian Science and New Thought, which I had never heard of, but that's apparently a related 19th century metaphysical movement. And it also had like a bunch of like Freudian language in it, which it would, her being a psychiatrist.
Right.
It taught that reality was illusory.
Mm.
Yes. And it said conflicts dissolve when one realizes the power of love and forgiveness. This change in perception, the book's narrator says, produces miracles. Yes. The first sentence is, nothing unreal exists. Nothing real can be threatened. Herein lies the peace of God.
So it's also nonsense. It's 1,300 pages of, like, pure bullshit.
Yeah. Yeah. But interestingly, though, and this is different than, obviously, usually you think of people who have, like, started cuckoo religions. You think that it's because they knew that there was money in cuckoo religions. Yeah. Like, this is the story of Scientology. She was always... very unsettled by the fact that she wrote this. Her name is not on it.
Right.
It was like published basically like not with her, at least not on the cover anyway.
Anonymously, I
guess. So that's sort of odd considering that she sort of was like, you know, at least fancied herself a religious prophet
she didn't want to actually be one.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then she died in 1981.
Yeah.
The year of our Brent's birth.
That's right. Yes.
So it kind of the book sort of made its way through a lot of New York counterculture circles,
right? And also into the hands of Marianne Williamson.
Marianne Williamson, who was 20 years old.
And she was really the perfect person to get her hands on it.
Couldn't have
been more perfect because by this point she had already learned techniques of transcendental meditation.
Sure.
She had read books by Ram Dass and also Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh. And if you watched Wild Wild Country.
That's that guy. The people in the red.
The red or the orange, or whatever it was.
Yeah.
Or, yes, who like took over Portland and then started like trying to kill the locals, basically. Right. Yeah, that's that guy. She moved to New Mexico at one point to live in a geodesic dome on a commune. Yeah.
Come on.
Guys.
Well, that.
Yeah.
It's perfect.
But Williamson, 2020.
Eventually, she came to New York City to be a cabaret singer.
Yeah, she did.
And then in the 80s started teaching The Course. And that's when things really took off.
Yes.
She did a lot of work on the AIDS crisis.
Yeah.
And good work if you can separate it from her belief that curing AIDS had to do with miracles.
Right. And Darth Vader.
And Darth Vader.
Because she apparently famously advised someone, imagine the virus that causes AIDS as Darth Vader and then unzip his suit and allow an angel to emerge.
That was her AIDS cure.
Yeah.
It's weird that didn't
But
take
that
off.
Goes back to the Christian Science angle of this book, which
of
is
no
this,
science.
Which is the
the part that's no science in the book. Is
because
the
I've read
angle.
That.
You have?
Book. Yes.
Fascinating.
Because, one of my best friends
grew up a Christian scientist.
And I borrowed it. Yeah. What's it called? Oh, On Science and Health.
That's
Mary
right.
Baker Eddy. Yes. Yeah. It's also cuckoo crazy.
It's
but
not filled with science or health, I would
I'm
imagine.
Surprised that hasn't had like a
resurgence
like a moment.
I know the Christian scientists are like losing real estate left, right, and center. Meanwhile, fake churches like Mosaic and the Scientologists own all of Hollywood.
I know.
Because wasn't that Mosaic was in a Christian scientist church.
Yeah.
That used to be that was a
yeah,
big,
that was like one of the biggest
the
Christian
biggest,
science reading rooms that there was in the country.
And now it's a fake church for hipsters. Right. In any case. So in 1992, Marian Williamson publishes her first book, A Return to Love, Reflections on the Principles of A Course in Miracles. Mm. And that got her on Oprah.
Yes.
And this is where I want to remind everyone that Oprah Winfrey is a celebrity and not a politician and should not run for president. Right. Because the reason that Marian Williamson is a person that you have heard of because of Oprah fucking Winfrey.
Oh, the reason that a lot of these new age wackos are, that's Eckhart Tolle was one of, like she was, or he was on the, you know, her book list in the Oprah's book club or whatever. Mm-hmm. I mean, she really, at least in the
has a soft spot for miracles.
Yeah, she did. And when she had Marian Williamson on, she marveled at her, and she said that she herself had experienced precisely 157 miracles in her own life after reading Marian Williamson.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. Oprah's life is pretty fucking miraculous because she's one of the wealthiest people on Earth.
Right. Yeah.
But this is why you shouldn't necessarily allow a person who's personable to be the president.
Right. But then she became very famous and like was like known amongst celebrities to sort of like be this guru. She officiated Elizabeth Taylor's
this
wedding
is all happening at the same time.
Right,
she goes
exactly.
on Oprah because she's sort of moving in these celebrity circles because she'd already officiated Elizabeth Taylor's
wedding.
She did
a ceremony for Michael Jackson at Neverland Ranch. She offered counsel to the Clintons when she went to camp. She was invited to Camp David.
She was invited to Camp David. Marianne Williamson.
Right. She crossed paths with Donald Trump because
fan
he requested
of New Zealand.
Right. He requested her presence at Mar-a-Lago because Marla Maples wanted to meet her.
Yeah.
And she, Time magazine around this time called her Hollywood's New Age attraction.
And here's the thing. What she's selling is something we've been sold before in this town. And will be sold forever.
I mean, after she sold it.
Before.
Oh, it'll be,
it's going to be sold here forever.
Oh, it'll be continued to be sold until
what
the end
of time.
What we
call it right now is the secret.
Sure.
But what
it's
we called
the power
it
of
before
positive thinking,
was
that you can change literally
miracles.
Anything in your life.
By just thinking about it
By
hard
just
enough.
Thinking about it. And here are some of the things that she has had in various books that she's written. She's written, like, I think 12 or 13 books, and, like, most of them have charted somewhere on the bestseller list. But she wrote about weight gain, and she said, the cause of your excess weight is fear, which is a place in your mind where love is blocked.
Or calories, which is a scientific phenomenon.
On money, she said, many people fail to manifest money because on some deep level, they don't think they should.
Or maybe the economy is working against them.
You could just think money into your pocket.
Well, and that's a famous thing that you get told in L.A. all the time.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Manifesting things
If you watch The Secret or read The Secret, like, one of the stories is, like, literally somebody just imagining that checks will start arriving in their mailbox, and then they do.
Yeah. I've tried that many times.
Yeah, well, it doesn't work.
It doesn't work. I've believed in myself a lot during those times, and yet it's never happened for me.
She also said, disease is loveless thinking materialized.
Now, here's the thing. We now have the science to prove what disease is. We know a lot about disease. We don't know everything, sure.
Right.
I can't say there's no room for miracles.
Yeah.
But we know pretty clearly what disease is.
Yes.
And it is viruses that we have discovered in living things and can identify and know what they do when they attack your immune system.
That's right. Science.
It's science is what it is.
Yeah.
So in one of the reasons she got political is because in 2004, she decided she was going to get involved in advocating for the creation of a Department of Peace, which is one of her things that she's always talking about.
It is, yes. I believe that was taken up, or at least that was a very Denis Kucinich thing to do. Do you remember?
Oh,
yeah.
I sure do. Denis Kucinich.
Never forget.
Never forget. And also, we can't because he keeps coming up at weird times to make statements that are mildly inappropriate about things.
Well.
But in any case, so We know her here if, well, here's the thing. Not enough people know her here considering how much we should know her here.
I know.
Brent and I know her here because Brent and I follow politics. A lot of people who live in the district she ran in were calling me like, who the fuck is Marianne Williamson during the debate? So here's who she is. In 2010, she was thinking about running for Congress in California. I remember that because that's how I found out who she was.
Right.
In 2014, she did run for Congress in the 33rd district.
As an independent.
That's, isn't that Ted Lieu's district?
Yeah, I think so. And she got like fourth place in the jungle primary.
Right. You can't, the problem with jungle primaries is you don't know what's going on ever. Right. So we don't know what her.
And she wasn't running as a Democrat.
No, she was running as a mystic of some sort. But you would see signs for her around here,
yeah,
a place that's not in her district all the time.
Oh, yeah.
So if you lived in Ted Lieu's district in 2014 and do not know who Marianne Williamson is, check your life a little because you should at this point.
Exactly.
Anyway, but in any case, so that's why we know who she is.
Right. But now you know who she is.
Now you know who she
is. And I feel like to summarize it, this is from a recent interview that she did. She said, before the course, I felt like I was on a desperate journey to find God. But as much as I climbed up this huge flight of stone steps in front of a cathedral, my knees bloody and my elbows bloody, the cathedral door was locked. And when I read the course, I thought I understood the key.
So that's as meaningless as the first sentence of the course, which is already too long.
But anyway, that's the story of Marianne Williamson.
Yeah.
So now you know, because you probably didn't know. I didn't even know all of this.
No.
And like,
why
you've
would you
also
know?
Been wondering how she ended up on a debate stage. And even now that I have read this article in the New York Times, I'm still confused as to how she ended up on a debate stage. But
well, she's a best-selling author.
Regardless.
We're living in a time where celebrities run for president.
Yeah, now you know.
Now you know. She is the physical manifestation of what everyone hates about California.
No, totally.
Is what she is.
Yeah, she is.
She's like, it's like we vomited her onto America. And that is the podcast this week.
There it is.
We'll be back next week.
Bye.
Bye.